Mark Maron. It's 6 past the hour here on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, lurking conservatives. Good morning to the frightened. How are you, folks? Good morning to you, Mark Riley.
Good morning, Mark Maron.
Hi, Chris. Kayla, what's happening?
What's
everybody?
Up, baby?
I don't know, man. I don't know what's up. I just ran up and down the stairs 2 seconds before we went on the air. I broke in a sweat here. I got an air conditioner headache because last night in the middle of the night, I said, I better kick it on. It's getting a little hot. And I woke up. I was in a freezer. There was frost on my face. Unbelievable. So, Riley, you all right? Everything okay?
I'm great, man. I had a great weekend.
What'd you do? Let's sum it up.
Well, I went to a drum and bugle corps show, which is what I do during the summer.
But you said it was a small one.
It was a small one.
What does
that mean?
It was
smaller drum corps.
Okay.
They have different sizes. You know, they have like 60 people, and they got 130 people. So this was generally a smaller one.
Okay, all right. I just, I don't know, like, when it's a big drum corps thing, are there thousands?
Well, that's a giant stadium, yeah.
Okay, all right.
That's the big one.
Okay, what did I do this weekend, I asked myself.
I also went to see my man Kyle Ice Jason on Saturday night.
Oh, he had the record release party.
The record release party.
Is that what that was?
Yeah, Chuck D hosted. It was a really, that band is something.
Yeah?
That band is great.
Is it a big band kind of sound?
Soul Power Movement. Yeah, a couple
of
horns.
That's cool. I did some comedy down at the Comedy Cellar. It was nice.
Yeah.
It was nice to go out and do some comedy that I didn't tell anybody about. It lowered the expectations. Yeah. I could just go out try a few new jokes, maybe a few old ones, and just feel like a comic. It was kind of nice.
Why are you feeling your side, man? Are you getting that fat syndrome thing
No, it's
again?
The opposite, dude. I've been running. I was out in the world yesterday, down the track, running with my new iPod.
There you go.
I got my little run mixes going now. I swear to God, it didn't take me long to get addicted to that stupid thing. Man, unbelievable. Now I'm like calling my wife. I'm like, I didn't get a big enough iPod. I'm having literally size fights with my wife because I got her the 40 gig, right? So I got the 6 gig, and she's like, yeah, yours is tiny. And I'm like, well, you got to say that for me. When you're out of town, you got to say that to me. You know, say it to my face, man.
Uh-oh.
So, okay, let's get to the news and start moving through some of this stuff. First of all, I want to reach out to our friends in the Florida area.
Yeah.
You know, in Florida, Alabama, Mississippi has been declared disaster areas because of this horrendous storm, Dennis. I guess it's not panning out as bad as they thought, but obviously pretty bad. Bad enough to be considered a disaster in many of those regions. So hang in there, folks.
Yeah.
Our thoughts are with you today. Also, let's get to London and see what in the aftermath. There are no leads or suspects, Riley.
There are no leads. There are no suspects. And the British have taken the unusual step of calling in counterterrorism, intelligence, and law enforcement experts from throughout Europe to get with them over this past weekend about trying to figure out exactly who did this, because they've got no leads inside the country.
Yeah, apparently the MI5 has created a special relationship with Spanish officials, bomb explosive experts, to sort of decipher whether or not the explosives that were used in the British bombing were the same as the ones in Madrid, and whether they could figure out to tie, because they did have some suspects in Madrid, I believe.
They did have, well, yeah, they busted some people in Madrid. But what you're seeing now, Mark, is, you know, the British frustration at not being on top of this to begin with. They really thought that they had a very good handle. And as a matter of fact, most of Europe thought that the British had a very good handle on terrorists inside their country.
Yeah, they generally, the British intelligence unit, the MI5, is respected throughout the world as being one of the best, having the most access to the most information. So just this idea that they are reaching out to Europe is unusual to some Europeans. They're like, wow, they didn't know. That's scary. And apparently this is creating a movement within intelligence and counterterrorism officials throughout Europe to really consolidate and get on the same page, because usually that doesn't happen because of different ways of handling terror suspects, different judicial procedures, and different procedures of policing. But now they're really sort of coming together. It's sort of frightening, though. I read this. There was a memo or a dossier that was leaked, this Whitehall dossier, over the weekend, that I found fairly disturbing, because if it's right, I mean, England is in a pretty precarious situation in the sense that intelligence indicates, I'm quoting from, this is from the MI5, The intelligence agency in Britain. Intelligence indicates that the number of British actively engaged in terrorist activity, whether at home or abroad or supporting such activity, is extremely small and estimated at 1%. But in a Muslim population of 1.6 million, that's 16,000.
Yeah.
And they also estimate that 10,000 have attended conferences. And when you're considering that England is a country the size of New Mexico, and granted this is about, these numbers apply to all of Britain, that it seems like an incredibly large number to me. And it leads me to suspect because of we're going to get into the recruiting. There's been some indication that there's been some, recruiting at colleges. And
yeah.
The type of people that are involved that are looking to be recruited by these terrorist groups is not who you'd think. You know, because when we talk about Iraq being a terrorist manufacturing factory and that, you know, these new terrorists are making their bones fighting Americans, I mean, those will certainly be the grunts in whatever it is that this network, this army that is sort of manifesting itself. But it seems to me that they are recruiting very intelligent people.
Well, yeah, they're not just recruiting the poor and disaffected. And what the British are learning, much to their chagrin here, Mark, is that the Muslim recruiting, and particularly the Muslim recruiting that is aimed in some way, shape, or form at terrorism or fomenting terror, is as diverse as Britain itself.
Well, let's get into that in just a minute. Let's talk a little bit about Karl Rove and Matthew Cooper's email exchange. It seems that that our buddy Michael Isikoff,
yeah,
has broken a story that, you know, he's got the communication between Rove and Cooper, and whether or not it is, you know, is it damning? I would hope so. I would hope at least we can get a case for perjury out of this. But, you know, I'll tell you, it's not clear yet whether it is, Riley.
Well, see, Karl Rove right now is one of those tightrope walkers that you see in the circus. Mm-hmm. He has gone out on a limb here, and I mean on an extraordinary limb. And you're right, under certain circumstances, what has been made public so far could be construed as perjury on his part, although a couple of sources told Mike Lysikoff, who we'll talk to later this morning, in fact, that Rove's testimony and Cooper's emails are wholly consistent with each other. It really is going to come down to whether Rove knew that Valerie Plame was an undercover CIA operative, when he knew it, and when he discussed this issue with Matthew Cooper. It's all going to come down to that.
It's interesting. I was reading some stuff on the First Amendment, some analysis on the First Amendment, some commentary on this situation, and it's very interesting that when discussing the First Amendment, I read this piece by a guy named William Betts, and it was forwarded to me. What he says here is what the founding fathers were what they were concerned about when they agreed that a condition for the acceptance of the Constitution was the later adoption of the Bill of Rights. What were they concerned about? Were they concerned about protecting a press that was complicit in governmental corruption, or were they concerned about protecting a press that would expose governmental corruption? The answer is clear. They were concerned about protecting a press that would expose governmental corruption.
Yeah.
And it's just a very interesting, different angle on this, is that who carries water for a corrupt governmental administration intent on the wholesale destruction of its own nation and the personal destruction of anyone who takes issue with the deceptions underlying virtually every action of that administration. That is not what the First Amendment was set out to protect. The First Amendment, as he said, and I'll quote him because I thought it was fairly lucid, the First Amendment is designed not to protect the powerful. It's designed to protect challengers to the powerful. This case has nothing to do with the First Amendment. This is a story about the corruption of a complacent and self-satisfied press by a corrupt and arrogant government. So, you know, Judith Miller is just aiding and abetting a crime here.
Well, you know, Mark, if this government is as corrupt as I think many people are now starting to believe it is in terms of its conduct of the war in Iraq, in terms of its run-up to the war in Iraq, in terms of striking out at anyone who dissents from their particular view.
About anything.
Then you have to start asking yourself the following question. Is this president, is this administration qualified to name a Supreme Court justice? Now, that may sound like something that's completely off the wall, but ask yourself, do you really want somebody this corrupt naming someone who is going to decide American jurisprudence for the next God knows how many years?
No. 15 past the hour. We'll get back about terrorist recruiting in England. Stay with us. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. It's Monday.
You're listening to Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
No, we're not homosexual, but we are willing to learn.
Air America Radio.
Hold on, let me take my iPod off. All right, 20 past the hour, Mark Maron, that's Mark Riley.
Hi.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. I'm kidding, I didn't have it on. I'm so stupid. After months and months of fighting, and now I'm just like a compulsive, obsessive addict. Ridiculous. In a provision of the defense bill passed by Congress in May, Secretary of State Don Rumsfeld has until today, my friends, today, this is the day to send Capitol Hill a comprehensive set of performance indicators and measures of stability and security 2 years after the fall of Saddam Hussein. Well, Don, today's the day. What do you got? We're going to get into that in a second. Let's talk a little bit more about this recruiting of terrorists in England, Riley. I find it pretty fascinating that apparently a number of extremist terrorist groups are actively recruiting young British Muslims. Extremists are known to target schools and colleges where young people may be very inquisitive but less challenging and more susceptible to extremist reasoning. You know, when you have an existential crisis, is life worth it? What would make my life worthwhile? Why do I want to kill myself? How come I can't have sex with somebody? Then steps in, would you like to blow yourself up for your country?
Well, I mean, I think...
For your religion, not for your country.
Well, there are probably some intermediate steps there. Religious recruitment takes an awful lot of forms.
Yeah.
And that's across the board, in terms of monotheistic religions. In a lot of cases, Mark, what seems to end up happening is that if you give people a sense of belonging, if they're isolated, if they're in school and they feel like they're the only ones going through things, and then someone comes to them and says, well, no, you're not alone, and, you know, we can show you how to get past these kinds of feelings, that is a very, very powerful tool.
Sure, that happens all the time. It's they're looking for an army of suspicious-looking loners, people who can't fit in that want to fit in. I hear you. The interesting thing to me about what's going on in England in response to terrorism is that they've really taken a different approach than the United States in how they've handled this, and whether that's going to change, you know, right now after this horrendous attack, I don't know. But the British government has been using the courts to
yes.
prosecute terrorism. They've been using law enforcement to keep a tab on terrorist cells and groups. Now, obviously, something fell through the cracks last week.
Yeah, something fell through the cracks, but the fact is that under British law, they are constricted from or restricted from doing certain things that Americans would probably say, well, why aren't they doing that?
You well, now I think that we're going to see is like I think what we're seeing a little bit of in Britain is a similar reaction to some Americans after 9/11. I think that the defense, Minister of Defense or the Secretary of Defense over this guy,
yeah.
Clark, his reaction is, well, we've got to figure out more ways to get these guys behind bars, to get these guys in front of the courts. We've got, you know, it was that reaction that we had here.
Yeah.
Whereas before, you know, there's another school of thought there that comes from this this Whitehall dossier that was, leaked in terms of how to deal with terrorism. And it's interesting because they deal with it. There's 5 points. Research. Is more needed to be clearer about the nature of the problem? Communication, are we listening enough to the Muslim communities and understanding what we hear? Economic opportunity, are programs to ensure economic opportunity for all parts of the Muslim community adequate? Social and cultural issues, is the only response better communication? Foreign policy, how do we communicate our foreign policy to the Muslim community? This is obviously a country that, as I said before, is small and has a huge, long-standing Muslim community.
Well, yeah, 1.6 million Muslims living in England. And what you have, Mark, is a very diverse group of Muslims that live in England.
Mm-hmm.
You have everybody from, for example, foreign nationals who have been living in the UK for some time, from North Africa, from the Middle East. You've got British citizens whose forebears come from Pakistan or Kashmir, who were born Muslim inside the UK. And then you also have Muslim converts, people who have converted in their late teens, early 20s, converted while in college, converted as adults. Many of those are either British nationals who are white or people from the former British colonies, particularly in the West Indies.
Because even, yeah, so even when I was there, and you know, you obviously have been there more than me, is that the Muslim community in all its diversity is very woven into British culture. It's not, you don't feel a big separation like you do here in America. There is not, you know, this not two different sides. It is an intrinsic part of modern British culture.
Yeah, and that's why so many people were completely freaked out by the fact that one of the explosions took place at Edgware Road, which is the heart of a predominantly, well, not a predominantly Muslim, but the heart of a large Muslim community inside London.
Yeah, even in tone of some of the services, the church services that were being held in London and in Britain over the weekend. You know, the Queen and Prince Charles were visiting the wounded in London hospitals, but there was a church service by a fellow named Reverend Paul Hawkins. Mm-hmm. This was at the St. Pancras Parish Church. It's right where the bus killed 13 people. And I quote something he said, quote, "There are no Muslim terrorists. There are terrorists. There are criminals who claim to be Muslims. We all know that the vast majority of our Muslim friends and neighbors are as horrified and disgusted at what has happened as we are," end quote. Now, this is, you know, literally 2 days after.
Yeah.
You know, this type of language I don't think was heard that quickly after 9/11, certainly. And obviously what happened in England, not as horrendous in toll as 9/11. But it's interesting when you have a culture that is as integrated in terms of Muslims as England, that right away they were very clear to offer distinctions and to talk about, you know, what you were talking about, which is that this is, you know, this is a specific group of criminals.
It's a very specific group of criminals. But now the challenge for Tony Blair is to beat back the perception that this had, excuse me, had something directly to do with British involvement in Iraq. Because he's been saying and continues to say that that's not the case, that this bombing, this series of bombings, had nothing to do with British with the British presence inside Iraq.
Well, it's interesting because in just a few minutes we're going to talk about how there's another memo out of England.
Memo's just springing out of there, aren't
that,
they?
That imply that there is definitely an exit strategy for England.
Yeah,
and
not
that,
for us.
Yeah, and that the U.S. is on the fence.
Yeah,
but has some plans. So stay with us, and we'll get into that. We've also got Michael Isikoff coming up later in the hour, whose story broke today about the Matthew Cooper Karl Rove communication.
Oh, yeah. We got a whole bunch of guests this morning. We got some great folks. So stay with us, Michael Isikoff, and more next on Air America Radio.
Morning Tradition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
I don't remember putting this song on my iPod. Oh, I'm on the show. It's a show. It's 34 past the hour. Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program with Mark and Mark. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Good morning.
We'll be broadcasting live this Friday from Restaurant Florent on Gansford Street in the Meatpacking District. Man, that's right down the street from where I used to get those porterhouses back in the day when I ate the meat.
Uh-oh.
Oh, the place is open 24 hours, and we expect some holdovers from the previous night's Bastille Day celebration, so it's going to be interesting and fun. We'll also be giving away free coffee and other cool stuff. That's this Friday at Restaurant Florent on Gansford Street in the Meatpacking District. Please, folks, we got to tell you, last month we were urging people to donate to a sweepaway camp for poor kids from the Bronx. Recently, we learned that the youth clubs that were operating the camp and taking the donations were shutting down. Not long after that, it was reported that the clubs are under investigation by city officials. Needless to say, we ended our promotion of the camp as soon as we heard all this, and we recommend that all of you stop donating to the clubs, at least until all this gets worked out. If you already donated money, you have two options. If we don't hear from you, your donation will go to other organizations that help disadvantaged city kids, or you can contact us by email at sedition@airamericaradio.com, and we'll arrange for your reimbursement. Obviously, we're disappointed and sorry about all this, and we'll pass on any more relevant information we can. My producer, Brendan P.W. McDonald, just handed me a story here that I think is important, and I think it is important that we acknowledge it and report it here, Riley. Apparently, the federal government is refusing to reimburse the city of New York about $26.8 million for crisis counseling provided after 9/11. And they're accusing New York City as not keeping good records.
Yeah,
like it's our fault. The books are off.
Yeah, this is a very strange story because there is, to some extent, a city level to this and also a state level to this because there's a state office, the State Office of Mental Health, couldn't cough up that money. It actually had gone through the state. And the feds are saying that they just, the city's education department just kept very, very shoddy records, so shoddy, in fact, that they're not going to release the
$26.8 million. And this goes along, they're just pinching pennies here because they're trying to take back about $125 million that was allotted for New York in the last budget to accommodate workman's comp situations that could unfold over the years. And they're saying because it wasn't used, they want it back. And now they're trying to balk. And money owed for crisis counseling. I mean, hell, half the city needed was in post-traumatic stress disorder.
Well, see, that's the thing. I don't know about the record-keeping, but I do know that there were literally thousands of people here in New York who sought some form of counseling in the immediate aftermath of September 11th. Many of them were, in fact, caregivers, people who stayed down at Ground Zero for days on end after the initial attacks,
yeah,
just to help people. They were manning the food things for the police and fire people that were down there. So there were a lot of folks that sought that counseling, and it was my impression, Mark, I could be wrong about this, but it was my impression that counseling was, A, needed, and, two, very, very effective.
Helped a lot of people. And who the hell is the federal government to talk about bookkeeping? There's $8.8 billion in Iraq funds missing.
Yeah, talking about shoddy record keeping.
They're just pinching pennies. They got something against us. I read some speculation on the blogs. We'll get into that.
Hey, Maren.
Hey, what?
Sorry to interrupt you, but Future Mark is on line one.
Future Mark, he's my favorite. Put him through. Hey, buddy, what's up?
Hey, buddy, what's up?
So what's going on in 2050?
I'm on Celebrity Island, man.
Whoa, Celebrity Island? Is that good or bad?
Well, you know, some of both.
All right, okay, so what is Celebrity Island? You're going to have to explain that.
Here's what happened. Around 2024, a massive earthquake dropped most of California into the Pacific.
Oh, man.
So, of course, the celebrities and their clones kind of freaked out. They had nowhere to go, and they spread all over the country.
Uh-huh.
Well, that didn't work out. Celebrities are no good around regular people.
Uh-uh.
They trashed hotel rooms, they broke up families, and, you know, you can't really scream at a waiter like that in Topeka.
All right, so what happened?
Well, the government, in the interest of public safety, rounded them all up and shipped them here to this beautiful tropical island, Celebrity Island.
An island, huh? Wow, so what's that like? It's like a jungle paradise or something?
No, actually, it's an exact replica of Malibu, Palm Springs, and there's a Tribeca section for the New Yorkers.
So wait, let me get this straight. So celebrities don't mind being confined to this island?
No, they love it. They're waited on hand and foot by an army of docile Mary Harts and James Whipton clones. It's like an ego fest 24/7, buddy.
Hmm.
Here, listen.
Future Mark Maron, would you like to see the dessert menu? And what is your least favorite word?
See what I mean?
Welcome to Sherwood, my lady.
Was that Errol Flynn?
Oh, yeah. One other thing. All the old celebrities got cloned, and they're here, too.
Uh-huh.
Flynn's tagging every talent site, man. It's unbelievable. Right now, he's trying to nail Jessica Simpson.
Really?
Whoa, correction. Earl Flynn is nailing Jessica Simpson right now.
Whoa.
Right in front of me.
Wow.
Oh, he's good. He's very good.
So what does everybody do there?
Well, pretty much what you'd expect. They get drunk, snort a lot of coke, go to clubs, and order a bunch of food they don't eat. But mainly, they just do each other.
Oh, man, that's kind of creepy.
Yeah, plus, get this. The whole place is covered in red carpets because they have award shows every night, and everyone's a winner.
I knew it, man. Wow. All those neurotic Hollywood types on one island, that's got to be a nightmare, right?
Big time. Sometimes they get so agitated they throw their poop at you.
Wow.
Yeah. Shirley Temple nailed me right in the face once.
Oh.
Disturbed doesn't even begin to describe how I felt, my friend.
That is so freaky, man. So, all right, well, no offense, buddy, but what are you doing there?
I got a special visa to visit one of my clones, Celebrity Mark.
Oh, cool. We become a celebrity?
No, just Celebrity Mark.
No.
Here, why don't I just put him on the phone? Hey, Celebrity Mark, say hi to the original Mark. Hey, man. So you're a civilian, like from olden times. That must suck.
It's okay. I mean, I'm doing okay. Well, so, like, congratulations, I guess.
How'd you get to be a celebrity?
Well, they say I killed Dakota Fanning. There was a big trial and tons of press. I was acquitted. I got a series.
That's so messed up, man.
Yeah, whatever, man. Hey, it's, come here. You call this pomegranate sauce? Well, look, you tell that crappy chef to get it right, or I'm going to do his wife right here on the table. All right? Don't look at me. Just do it. Go tell him now.
Whoa, dude.
By the way, oh, I'm so sorry, Celebrity Mark. This will never happen again. God, I'm so stupid.
That's
I'm
okay.
So sorry.
That's okay, assistant to Celebrity Mark. You are stupid. All right? Just keep saying it. I'm back. Sorry about that, Original Mark. I'm a little on edge. I was up all night clubbing with Clooney, Lee Marvin,
yeah.
Fatty Arbuckle.
Wow, that's quite a bunch. That's cool, man. So, but, you know, let's be honest here, Celebrity Mark. It's not like you're really hanging out with those guys. I mean, they are clones.
Whoa, Original Mark. Listen, buddy, we don't use the C word. They're just much happier not knowing.
Oh, okay, sorry. I see how that could be a problem. So, hey, Future Mark, do you think it'd be okay if I got some advice from Celebrity Mark this week?
Yeah, sure. Kiss ass. Here he is, the star. Talk to you later.
Okay, so Celebrity Mark, do you have any advice for me from the future?
Definitely. Murder Dakota Fanning, and you get to nail Rita Hayworth. Later, man.
Later.
Go get my car, monkey.
Wait, I'm so sorry, Celebrity Mark.
Oh, jeez. What is that?
Ooh.
All right, let's. Hey, you know, there's another memo. You know, I just also want to say this before I get too far into this next story that we are going to be talking about this provision, a little known provision of the defense bill passed by Congress in May, where Secretary of State Don Rumsfeld has until today to send Capitol Hill a comprehensive set of performance indicators and measures of stability and security 2 years after the fall of Saddam Hussein. Today is the day. The information required is specific and detailed. It includes measures of the security environment, the count of trained Iraqi forces, indicators of economic activity, an estimate of U.S. military needed in Iraq through the end of 2006, which is interesting because another secret memo out of London, written by the British Defense Secretary for Tony Blair, states that many of the 8,500 British troops in Iraq could be returning home in 3 months and more 6 months later. One of the reasons is money, apparently. The British Defense Secretary Reid says cutting troop numbers to 3,000 could save Britain about £500 million a year. The document called Options for Future UK Force Posture in Iraq is the first proof that there is a plan for exiting in place.
They call it a military drawdown. Now, what people perhaps are not aware of is that British troops have largely been responsible for patrolling the southern section of Iraq. Now, if this memo is true, and if the British do begin to withdraw, then someone is going to have to come across and pick up that slack. Because among the southern cities, I believe, is Basra,
mm-hmm.
Or one of the cities in that southern region mm-hmm. is Basra, which has been the scene of a great deal of violence. Now, there are about 8,500 British troops inside of Iraq at this point.
Total, right?
Total, yeah. And that many of the, you know, this memo says that many of them will be brought home inside 3 months. Now, what I think the Americans might be very afraid of here, Mark, is that the other, you know, we kind of make it sound as if nothing but the British and the Americans. It's not. There are still other countries that have troops there. And my guess is if the British leave, the rest of those countries will start withdrawing their troops more or less at the same time, leaving the entire responsibility for Iraq on the United States.
Well, that's interesting because apparently in the same memo, there's a revelation about the American troops is that, and I'll quote the memo, there is a strong U.S. military desire for significant force reductions. Emerging U.S. plans assume 14 out of 18 provinces could be handed over to Iraqi control by early 2006, allowing a reduction in Allied troops from 176,000 down to 66,000. There is, however, a debate between the Pentagon and CENTCOM, who favor a relatively bold reduction in force numbers, and the multinational force in Iraq, whose approach is more cautious. So these, I don't know what it really means, Riley. It means that there are plans on the table. This is lip service to something. And the weird thing is, last week we reported that the British Ministry of Defense had drafted plans for a significant withdrawal of troops from Iraq, over the next 18 months, but a big deployment in Afghanistan where they were going to fill in for us, for the U.S.
Yeah. I don't know how anybody, I mean, at this point, it would seem to me that if the British were going to start deploying to Afghanistan, it would be to supplement the U.S. presence, because remember that Hamid Karzai, the president of Afghanistan, will acknowledge himself that he doesn't control the southern part of the country.
Yeah.
These southern parts of these countries seem to be a very, very problematic situation. But what we're seeing now is the idea of putting more of this weight on the Iraqis. Now, how does that square with the former President Alawi standing up and saying, you know, Iraq is sliding toward a civil war, and we're three quarters of the way there?
Yeah, and also that Zarqawi, who apparently was on medical leave, is back, and he's apparently created a new brigade specifically to attack the new Iraqi government.
Yeah, that's the Omar Brigade, I believe.
Specifically designed to attack the Iraqi Revolutionary Council. Is that what it's called?
Yeah, the Iraqi Sistani Group.
Yeah, no, it's going to come. It's going to come. The Islamic Revolution in Iraq, which is the country's largest Shiite political party. I've just been informed that Brian from Everett is on the phone waiting to sing for us. And also, Jeb Bush decided to go ahead and let Terry Schiavo die. Stay with us. 46 past the hour. Air America Radio's Morning's Edition with Mark and Mark.
Oh, Franken, nothing to lose. Makes you laugh at the troubling news. Sometimes I wonder if he's hitting the booze. Al Franken,
King of the Jews.
Air America Radio.
It's a little Talking Heads, man. Sorry, I'm just listening to music sometimes. It's 51 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning's Edition with Mark and Mark. See what the iPod's training me?
It's
like as soon as I hear music in my head, I'm like, I can detach. I know what that sound is. That's our weekly liberal agenda from the Streisand compound. So let's give this a read, liberal soldiers. Write these down. Here are your marching orders for the week. 1. Expand vegan principles to the next level. Refuse to engage in meaty discussions. 2. Start a filibuster at Viacom headquarters to block any possible nomination of Judge Judy to the Supreme Court.
Whoa.
3. Declare Hurricane Dennis's destructive path through Florida as God's punishment for not approving gay marriage. Yeah. 4. To fight national obesity, propose movie title change: Charlie and the Organic Sprouts Farm. No. 5. Today's phrase, just drop it into conversation. The Fantastic Four is the most realistic film Hollywood ever made. In a group of powerful people, there's only one woman, and she's invisible, man. Wake up, sheeple. Even female superheroes can't break through the glass ceiling.
Whoa.
Let me tell you a little bit about Brian and Everett. Brian and Everett's been a loyal listener for since the beginning, back since 1977, when we started the network. And he's up. And he's opinionated and peculiar, and he's written songs for us, and I need you to know about Brian. Brendan P.W. McDonald, our producer here at the show, went upstairs to check the show's messages, and I think in maybe a 3-day period, it might have even been an afternoon, there were 44 messages from Brian. And we're happy he's on the phone, but we'll give you a little intro, a little primer. Here's a Brian from Everett primer.
Since I've got this newfound fame, I'm going to embark on a political career, I think, just to leap off from this show.
Yeah, I think this is the beginning for you,
bro. Yeah, I have a new political party. It's called the Anti-Social Socialist Party.
That sounds good. Is it just you in it?
My slogan is, do I have to leave the house?
Oh, wow. I'll vote for you, Brian.
All right, that was Brian from a little while ago on our show, and now apparently he's on the phone.
What's up, buddy?
Hey, oh.
What's up, Brian?
How you
good
doing?
Good morning, Everett. It's 3:53 a.m.
How you feeling? You're up, huh?
Oh, I'm up, man. Boy, you know, I tell you what, I'm going to work today. You know, I work at the Daily Work, Daily Pay places.
Okay,
you
know? Yeah, that's vague, but I understand.
And this is how, now, I know
you in your studio know what it's like to work with quality, high-minded, sensitive people. Am I right?
Yes, sir. Sure. Absolutely.
Okay. Now, here, I'm going to be going to this job. And
okay.
I got to scrounge up some cash. And this is kind of maybe the dilemma a lot of people are in, people of sensitive dispositions.
Of course.
Inconsistently sensitive and all that.
Yeah, okay.
But I have to go to work and work around these basically Everett is a town full of people who take the color of their necks very proudly. I put it that way.
Okay.
And
the rednecks, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
And they're kind of cruel, and they're kind of hateful, and they're kind of nasty.
Yeah.
So I wrote this song to get myself worked up to go to work because I need some cat food.
Okay. All right.
I need to get some cat food today.
So this is a song that's going to propel you to get cat food.
And also get my VCR out of the pawn shop.
And get your VCR out of the pawn shop. Let's hear it.
Okay, here we go. Should I go to work today, or should I give it a pass? Should I take my sensitive alien brain to the United States of Ass? It'll be 8 hours of labor for just about 50 bones, but I've got to power through it and conjure up the stones to endure the rogues and felons who will drink and fight at a bar so I can see some melons when I get my VCR out of the pawn shop. 'Cause it's one-stop shopping for me, 'cause it's amateur night at the compound and the seeds will be popping for me. Now when I go back to work,
yeah,
I'll leave my lovin' at home, and I'll be disgusted by the needle freaks who party in the Thunderdome. I may sound like a hypocrite, but I know what's good for me, and I believe in reproductive freedom, and I can see what I choose to see. Now you may call me a loser, and you may call me a jerk, but neither Dr. Dobson nor Janine Garofalo can get my Jimmy to work. So it's back to the pawn shop, 'cause it's one-stop shopping for me, 'cause it's amateur night at the compound, and tomorrow will be laundry day for me.
Yeah! That was a good one, Brian. That was a lot of work, and it had a couple of verses.
So that's $20 you owe me now.
Okay.
But I decided I'm going to donate. What happened to your charity, by the way? Was it the galvanizing traumas of the moonlight hazings? Is that why they're under investigation?
Hey. Wait, one of these days we're going to have to do a thorough, in-depth interview with you, Brian.
Because I've taken a vow of poverty.
Okay.
Because I'm unemployed.
Right, well,
it's handy. It's a good way to look at it.
Well, thank you for calling with this song.
You're so welcome, and keep up the good work. And again, pray for the Maronites over in Lebanon there.
Okay, and I hope you get your VCR working.
And all that.
Okay, all right. Take it easy, Brian. We'll be back. We got Michael Isikoff from Newsweek to break some news with us about Karl Rove.
Yeah, we got an action-packed hour coming up. So don't miss it. This is Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Six past the hour, it's Morning Sedition with Mark and Mark. You're listening to Air America Radio. I'm Mark Maron, that's Mark Riley.
Yeah.
We'll be broadcasting live this Friday from Restaurant Florent on Gansevoort Street. Gansevoort Street in the Meatpacking District. The place is open 24 hours. Been around for a while. I've been there once or twice in my life.
Yeah.
We expect some holdovers from the previous night's Bastille Day because it's a celebration because we open 24 hours. So it's going to be an interesting.
Well, yeah, and they apparently have the best known Bastille Day celebration in the city of New York.
What does?
Yeah. Restaurant Florent.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
I had no idea.
Yeah, it's no
fun. So we'll be giving away free coffee. and you know, the stuff that we give away. So let's get into this a little bit. You know, I got to tell you honestly, I'm so sick of kale. I am sick of beets. I'm sick of vegetables. Like on Sunday night, I do this thing where it's like whatever's left in my refrigerator from the week, I eat it all.
Really?
And there's nothing worse than eating something with contempt. You know, like I'm sitting there going, "What do I? I'm tired of it." But it's
but you ate it anyway.
Well, yeah, but it was a few days old. That's all. And I bought this soy mozzarella. Well, how sad is that?
Uh-oh.
Dude, I'm telling you, it melts just like the real stuff. It tastes pretty good. I'm not even sure why I bought it. I'm just trying stuff, right? Because some guy told me that if I cut back on my wheat and I cut back on my dairy intake, that I'll feel a lot better and things will be good in my body.
Yeah, how's that working out?
Excellent. Thank you. Excellent. All right, Chubbs? Really, it is Chubbs.
Really,
it is.
You weren't the one just, before the show, just running downstairs because you forgot something and flipping out, as usual. I used to love the fat guys.
The thing is, what happened was, I left something downstairs, and how quick did it happen? I was up and back. Riley said, "Did you go all the way downstairs?" You know why? Because I'm light on my feet.
Uh-oh.
I got, what do you call it in your step? What do you call it?
Yeah.
Peppin? No, it's something else. What is it? Spring? Yeah, I have spring in my step.
Oh.
I do. And I've... All right. Yes. Folks, let's switch gears. Hang in there, Florida, Alabama, Mississippi. All have been declared...
Georgia, too.
Georgia, parts of Georgia. It's all been declared a disaster area this morning because of the Hurricane Dennis, which is not as bad as they said, but it's pretty bad.
Yeah.
It's pretty bad in some areas. Our thoughts are with you this morning. Also, speaking of Florida, Governor Jeb Bush, I don't know how he got to be the guy that was the guy that gets to say this since he caused all the trouble. Jeb Bush has declared an end to the state's inquiry into Terri Schiavo's collapse 15 years ago and, conversely, an end to the crucifixion of her husband Michael by the Christo Fascist Zombie Brigade. State Attorney Bernie McCabe said that Michael Schiavo called 911 after her collapse. There may have been inconsistencies in the record, but Schiavo's statements have been consistent. McCabe said, quote, "That consistency coupled with the varying recollections of the precise time offered by other interested parties led to the conclusion that such discrepancies are not indicative of criminal activity." Good. Let Michael Schiavo live a life, for God's sakes. And the fact that Jeb Bush gets to say, "Hey, I'm calling it a day on this thing," screw that guy. You know what I mean? He's a guy that wanted to manipulate this and exploit it with his brother and with all the freaks, DeLay and the other religious fanatics, to their benefit politically, and it backfired, and this guy doesn't deserve the right to say this. You know, he only said this because he realized that this was done.
You know, in the words of one politician who was tried and acquitted, where does Michael Schiavo go to get his life back now? I mean, this was a guy who was savaged in the media at a point. There were allegations that he actually physically abused Terri Schiavo.
I'll tell you something. I think that there's plenty of people out there that think Michael Schiavo has been, nothing but a decent dude throughout this whole thing. Because something this polarizing, you know, I think that his behavior was decent, and that the way he handled the press was also decent, and he just took the hits, and I think he'll be fine. The medical examiner down there was unable to determine with reasonable certainty that the manner of death, of course, is 15 years after the fact, and I hate to break it to you, but, you know, CSI isn't real. So, you know, it was probably a little more difficult than it might be imagined, but McCabe said that the most likely cause of her collapse is the one thing, the cause that was stated originally, an eating disorder, folks, and that's the reality.
Yeah.
Okay. In a provision of the defense bill passed by Congress in May, Secretary of State Don Rumsfeld owes us something today. He owes Congress something today. Today is July 11th. He had until today to send Capitol Hill a comprehensive set of performance indicators and measures of stability and security 2 years after the fall of Saddam Hussein. Well, Don, today's the day. We're going to have a guest later in the show, Peter Galbraith, who is going to address this congressional provision and tell us how important it is and whether or not, how many of these things we met.
Well, you know, I don't think Don Rumsfeld at this point is in a position to release this kind of information because, quite frankly, the Bush administration had no plan for the aftermath of the war. They had a really elaborate plan to make the war, But in terms of how Iraq was going to function after they were finished, I don't think they had a clue.
Well, there is incremental progress in certain areas, but as I said, it's very small, and it is in relation to an extremely profound and escalating violence on a day-to-day basis in Iraq and now Afghanistan. And now we have these terror attacks in London, and there are no leads, no suspects. The assumption, I believe, is that the suspects probably lived and came from England.
Yeah.
Is what I understand. And British officials have reached out to counterparts in the United States and in Europe to develop some leads into who is responsible for the four explosions that killed 49 people and wounded over 700 last week.
You know, this should be instructive for us as a nation. The British did not call their European allies to send troops. They didn't ask the Americans to send troops. What did they ask people to do?
Share intelligence
and send law enforcement people and intelligence people mm-hmm. to deal with this. Mm-hmm. And the fact of the matter is, you know, we reported without a great deal I don't want to say analysis, but we reported earlier that Zarqawi had left and gone and gotten an operation and had come back to wherever inside Iraq where he'd been. How can people just sit there and act as though this guy, who is one of the most wanted people on the face of the earth, can go get a medical procedure, return from the medical procedure, and no one there, we know that he did this, but we have no idea where it was done, what doctor did it. There was no attempt, apparently, to apprehend the guy during this time.
It's interesting. That's a good point, Riley. And it's like, you know, how do they know that much yet not know
where it happened?
Is it the Al Qaeda hospital?
Oh, I'm sorry. You know, was that the one in Europe or in London?
Well, they've got a lot of branches. It's a pretty organized health plan. Al Qaeda has some of the best health benefits. It's odd because they're terrorists. But anyway, so look, Matthew Cooper, whose hard drive and information and notes were turned over to the grand jury investigating the leak of Valerie Plame's name to Robert Novak, which compromised her CIA identity. Mm-hmm. As she is the wife of Joe Wilson, Ambassador Joe Wilson, who's been fighting for this. The CIA, I assume, is the one the CIA brought up the case. I mean, the grand jury decided it was worth investigating because the CIA said, look, you know, we've been compromised here.
Well, yeah, and the Congress also said, look, we need to have some hard information about this.
Well, now, after all is said and done, Judith Miller is in jail. She's not going to reveal her sources. She's going to stay complicit with a criminal administration because she's got some sort of payoff coming after her jail time in the form of a book and maybe, who knows, maybe a post in government. But Matthew Cooper, as it turns out, his stuff, his communications with Rove have been, they've been read. They're out, and Michael Isikoff has them. Now, what we're going to talk to Michael Isikoff about next is whether or not there's enough here to implicate Rove and charge him with perjury. Is this thing going to go away? What does it mean for the case? What does it mean for the press? And what is happening right now with this case?
In other words, is he going to be able to weasel his way out of this? Karl Rove is a very, very clever man. Did he give himself enough wiggle room to escape an indictment here?
And this is breaking news here. This is coming out today in Newsweek. The documents of the conversation, the email communication between Rove and Cooper, and we're going to talk to the man that broke it after this. It is 15 past the hour. You're listening to Morning's Edition with Mark and Mark. It's Air America Radio.
From Monty Python, and you're listening to Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Morning Sedition. They're not the Messiah, they're very naughty boys on Air America Radio.
Twenty past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. In just a couple of minutes, we'll be talking to Newsweek's Michael Isikoff, who is breaking some news with, apparently I misspoke. It's not Matthew Cooper's correspondence with Rove. It's Matthew Cooper's correspondence with his editor at Time Magazine about conversations he had with Rove. Now, there's a lot of stuff, you know, in the mix here that, you know, the real question is that did they have a conversation about Valerie Plame before Robert Novak broke Valerie Plame's name? And apparently that, you know, that the Novak's piece could have broke a couple of days before it was actually published.
Yeah, it was published on the 14th, I believe, and the question is whether or not it was in circulation as early as the 11th, which was, I believe, the date that Cooper told his editors he had that conversation with
him. Later in the show, a little later, we're going to be talking to Jim Moore as well, the author of Bush's Brain, who has been, Carol Rove's been the bane of his existence for some almost 20 years at least. So here we go. Michael Isikoff, investigative reporter with Newsweek magazine, has broken another story in the saga today, and he joins us on the phone this morning from Maryland. Michael, good to have you again.
Good morning.
So last week we knew that Cooper and Rove had at least communicated with each other prior to Valerie Plame's name being made public. Since then, you found out what they were talking about, and what can you tell us about that conversation?
Well, what we have is the email that that Cooper wrote to his bureau chief right after he got off the phone with Rove, and it was at 11:07 a.m. on Friday morning, July 11th. Subject Rove, PNC, personal confidential. And it starts out, I mean, there's a couple of interesting things in it. Now, and first of all, the email starts out saying, this is double super secret background. Got off the phone with Rove. And we spoke for 2 minutes, and he's given Cooper a heads up, big warning on this Wilson story. Don't believe everything Wilson is saying. You know, his trip to Niger wasn't authorized by Tenet, wasn't authorized by Cheney. It was Wilson. It was, the email reads, and this is quoted in this week's Newsweek, KR said, Wilson's wife, who apparently works at the agency on WMD issues, who authorized the trip. So, look, I mean, the significance of this, and then it ends with, please don't source to Rove or the White House, or WH, is what it says. This is significant on a couple of levels. Number one, they have met even last week after we first reported that Rove was one of Cooper's sources. They were still not willing, they being Rove and his lawyer, Robert Luskin, willing to acknowledge that they had spoken about the Wilson-Valerie Plame matter at all, that Rove had spoken at all to Cooper about this. And so that when we had that remarkable scene in the courthouse the other day on Wednesday, in which Cooper said he got this last-minute communication from his source, there was still confusion as to, was it Rove? Was it somebody else? And in fact, the Washington Post reported the next day that, relying on comments from Robert Luskin, that there was that Rove didn't call Cooper, that it must have been some other source. Well, this clears up the matter. Once I read the email to Luskin on Saturday, he dropped all pretense, acknowledged that, in fact, it was Rove who was Cooper's source. It was Rove through he being Luskin, who communicated with Cooper's lawyer on Wednesday.
Gave the okay.
Gave the okay. And, and it is, pretty conclusive evidence that at least as of Friday morning, which is before the Novak column would have circulated around. I mean, it doesn't go out into distributors until later in that day, and of course it wasn't published until Monday, but that Rove was spreading information about Wilson's
before
wife being at the CIA. Now, on the other hand, let's be fair and be clear. He doesn't use Valerie Plame's name in this conversation, at least as reflected in the email. So, if this all revolves on did he out Valerie Plame as a CIA operative, he may have an out there. I mean, or he may have a, totally legitimate response.
But once
I didn't use her name.
But,
it does say who apparently works at the agency, so it's not clear that exactly how much Rove knew. And there's nothing in the email that indicates he knew of her covert status, which is important for establishing criminal exposure under the Intelligence Identities Protection Act.
Okay, so what you're saying is that he, by saying Wilson's wife, any reporter could have found out her name, but that doesn't mean that it doesn't implicate him in knowing that she was an undercover agent, and it also doesn't have him actually saying her name.
All right, correct. I think that there are essentially two issues here as it relates to Rove. Number one, first and foremost, is what did he tell the grand jury? We know he's had three grand jury appearances. His story about who he spoke to and what he said is pretty much locked in. It's not pretty much. It is locked in. He's stuck with it. And the question is, you know, did he acknowledge what's in that email and what Cooper is now presumably going to testify to? This is what took place during this conversation. Did he tell that under oath to the grand jury? If he did, if he essentially did, then, you know, as far as the criminal investigation, you know, he may not have any problem at all. If he didn't, he may have a very big problem. We just don't know what he said to the grand jury. Number two is politically. Look, I mean, they have, the White House, Rove, yeah, through his lawyer, have pretty much denied all along that he played any role in this at all. You can look at those early White House statements, Scott McClellan, totally ridiculous that Rove may have been involved, and other comments. You know, that's a question that's very hard to judge. How much traction does the story get? Do people look at these previous comments? I mean, just last week, Robert Luskin, Rove's lawyer, was telling people that Rove had never been a confidential source for any reporter,
wow,
on this matter. Well, now, that's pretty hard to square with what Luskin is now acknowledging,
all right,
which is that they did have this conversation.
Well, Michael, you got to stay. Michael Isikoff, we got to check back in with you as this unfolds because we got to figure out what happens.
Yeah,
thanks a lot, Michael. We got Jim Moore to come on after this, who's known Rove for years, to respond to Michael Isikoff. It's Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Before past the hour, Mark Maron, here's Mark Riley.
Good morning.
Good morning, Sedition on Air America Radio. We got Jim Moore, the author of Bush's Brain, How Karl Rove Made George W. Bush a Presidential, also a Rove specialist going way back to his Texas days. Jim is in Texas, and he's our Rove specialist. But first, we know a lot of people out there are out of work and spent your Sunday leafing through the want ads. We want to help folks be part of the solution for you, not part of the problem. So here's our Morning Sedition Monday Help Wanted listing. Wanted, journalist / jailbird. The New York Times is seeking reporters who have the skills necessary for today's journalism. Specifically, we want people who know how to keep their traps shut and do their time. The modern reporter should look good in an orange jumpsuit, know how to wield a shiv, and have a taste for homemade cocktails made from ketchup and orange juice fermented in a toilet tank. You should know how to toss a salad and fully realize the phrase has nothing to do with food preparation. This is an open-ended opportunity. The duration is pretty much up to you. Pay is negotiable, but will be made in cigarettes. And, of course, accommodations are provided. If you are interested in this position, please talk to Karl Rove and then adamantly refuse to admit that you ever did so. Finks, rats, snitches, squealers, and stoolies need not apply. Oh, and on an unrelated note, neither should Jason Blair. According to our next guest, quote, nothing that happens in Rove's world is accidental, end quote. He's absolutely confident that Rove didn't just know about the leaking of Valerie Plame's identity, he orchestrated it. Jim Moore joins us on the phone from Austin, Texas. Good morning, Jim. Long time.
Yeah, guys. Where have you been?
How you doing, Jim?
I'm well.
We're waiting for the right moment, Jim. We're waiting for the right moment.
And this is it.
Okay. So, it's always the right moment when you can get people up early and get them talking about Karl Rove. That's what inspires me to get out of bed.
Well, you wrote Bush's Brain, How Karl Rove Made George W. Bush Presidential. You've been following this guy's career for 25 years. I assume on some level he's been the bane of your existence. And now,
all of that is true, but I have to tell you, a friend of mine the other day suggested that watching Rove squirm at the moment must be, for me, a special kind of pornography.
Is he squirming, Jim? Is there something that he needs to be afraid of? Is he not going to be able to outwit this one?
Oh, I think he gets away. I never ever bet against this guy, Mark. I'm telling you. The best piece of advice in all of this I can give anybody is never, ever believe anything Karl Rove or anything that Karl Rove's representatives say. If you had read the Washington Post and the New York Times last Thursday, you would have seen Luskin saying in the Post, Karl Rove is not asking anyone for protection, and he didn't speak to anyone.
This is Karl Rove's attorney.
Yeah, Luskin.
Yeah.
And then Robert Luskin. And then later that afternoon, he's on the phone negotiating in Rove's behalf with the New York with Time magazine to let Matt Cooper speak. And this was published in the New York Times, those negotiations and conversations, the same day that the Washington Post is reporting that Karl Rove isn't protecting him.
I saw that. It was crazy because it just canceled each other out.
Yeah. So what I'm suggesting is don't believe anything the guy says or his attorney says, because I think, frankly, Karl is at least partly pathological, that he just lives in this little world that he creates in the corner of his brain, and every now and then he comes out and interacts with reality.
But he's forcing us all to live in this dumb world of his, because you know he's manipulating the reality that we're being presented with here.
Yeah, and in this case, look, he went before the grand jury, as Iskov said, and everybody knows, three different times, and told them. I am told, and a number of other reporters, I think, have also said that he told that grand jury on three occasions that he did not speak to anyone about Valerie Plame prior to the publication of Novak's column. He has clearly given lie to that with these emails that Matt Cooper has written. So anybody who hopes Karl is going to go down is going to have to hope that he goes down based upon the whole idea that Patrick Fitzgerald is building a perjury case against him, that Karl lied to the grand jury, and these emails prove it. And I think that's why Fitzgerald has been pressing so hard for Matt Cooper to testify to support what these emails say. But Karl never got a target letter from the grand jury suggesting that he was a target. So I think that they came across this contradiction in the course of the broader investigation and have decided to concentrate on him.
Now, Jim Moore, I'm looking at Michael Isikoff's piece here, and you just heard him on the air with us. He mentions here that Valerie Plame, and he said it was Wilson's wife, apparently, authorized Ambassador Wilson's trip to Niger. Is that raised a red flag for me. I never knew covert operatives could authorize trips like this.
Well, there you go. I mean, I've spoken with Ambassador Wilson extensively through the past couple of years, and what he has told me consistently is that she may have gone, and he thinks she did go to, and say to her supervisors at the CIA, look, my husband is a former ambassador. He was familiar with that part of the world. He was an ambassador to an African nation under Bill Clinton. He would be comfortable going over there and making appropriate inquiries. He has lots of contacts. He concedes that she probably did that. What you have to know is that she's not in charge of authorizing anything. And the other thing for Rove to deny that he would even know about her is probably even more Rovian nonsense, because, look, this guy has a code security clearance at the White House, which authorizes him to acquire the highest level of intelligence and classified information. If Karl Rove wanted to call the CIA and say, I want a list of all your NOCs, non-official covers, who are the most secretive operatives, he could get that. And he probably did. When Wilson went over there, he wanted to see if there are any connections.
So, Jim Moore, let me ask, is there a possibility here? Okay, what you've established for us, and the best hope we have is that Rove can be prosecuted for perjury, for lying to the grand jury.
I think that's it, or possibly obstruction of justice.
Okay, now is there any chance here that nobody actually leaked Valerie Plame's name?
No, I don't think that's the case at all. It would be very difficult, even for someone like Robert Novak, to pick up the phone and call the CIA and say, hey, I'm trying to find out who your super-secret undercover agents are because somebody in the White House has told me X, Y, or Z. Somebody somewhere has leaked Valerie Plame's identity as a non-official covert agent to the media. Now, whether that was Karl Rove directly or not, I don't know. But I guarantee you that this didn't happen without Rove's knowledge and Rove's sort of implementation of the whole leak of her identity and getting it out there.
Because he's done this kind of thing before. He has a past relationship with Robert Novak, no?
No, absolutely. Here in Texas, very quickly, in 1994, when he was running the Bush for President campaign here in Texas, he was running around to all, or he was a mail order guy, direct mail guy for the campaign to raise money, and he's running around to a bunch of us reporters here in Texas trying to get us to write about how badly the campaign was being run. And we all called up the campaign and talked to our sources. Everybody said, oh, it's just fine. We're doing great. And none of us would write it. We found out later that Rove was angry because Robert Mosbacher Jr. had given Rove only about $500,000 of the $2 million in direct mail money that the campaign had, and he'd given $1.5 million to another direct mail company. So none of us wrote about it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, a short time later, a column appears in Robert Novak's newspaper and syndication suggesting that the campaign is in a state of disarray, and there was a secret meeting with the, George Bush and Phil Graham and Robert Mosbacher about how to salvage the campaign in Texas. Well, none of it turned out to be true, and George Bush fired Karl Rove because they just finally decided nobody else would have leaked that to Novak.
So that relationship goes back 10 years at least.
Oh, that's longer than even 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Jim, they've been sharing stuff.
Jim Moore, is it fair to say, leaving aside the leaking of Valerie Plame's name, is it fair to say that Karl Rove engineered a disinformation campaign against Ambassador Joe Wilson based largely, if not solely, on the results of his investigation in Niger?
I couldn't summarize it any better. They were angry. They wanted to fire a bow shot over the bow of anybody who thinks about contradicting the White House on what the White House wants to believe and sell to the public. And so this was a two-part thing. This was to send a message to anybody else who might stand up in government circles and say the White House is full of crap. And it was also to punish Joe Wilson for going public in a high-profile way with information that contradicted what the White House was trying to sell to the public. This is a perfect sort of Karl Rove method of doing things. It works on a number of different levels, and it absolutely was Karl.
What do you think of Judith Miller invoking the First Amendment here?
Well, look, I've written about Judy extensively over the past couple of years, and I think that she's nothing more than a White House stenographer. And for her to stand up, I mean, that's to me, it sort of indicates the sad state of journalism that she has become a martyr for the craft of journalism, because she's using the First Amendment to protect someone who has committed treason against our country, which is apparently, from what the president tells us, in the midst of a horrible, unavoidable war, and someone on his staff, within his administration, leaks the name of an agent who's trying to help us in this war, and leaks it to Judy Miller, among other reporters, and Judy Miller is protecting that person. I've suggested all along, I think that journalists have to appeal to a higher ethic, and in this case, the higher ethic is not protecting your source, it's protecting your damn country. And what good is your source and your craft of journalism if your country is blown up by nuclear weapons, for God's sake?
Yeah, and also the idea that the source, I think, you know, that usually is spoken about when protecting a source is somebody who's standing up to the powers that be and revealing a crime, not being complicit with the criminals themselves who are using her, or, you know, in terms of, and she's completely willing to be used to facilitate this crime.
Yeah, That's exactly the problem. You know, the downside of all this is it's going to have a chilling effect on other people who were once willing to leak material and talk to reporters on background, because that, of course, is the way that a lot of stories begin, and this is going to scare a lot of those people from doing that now, because they're going to worry that reporters are going to protect them. And And that's a bad thing.
Jim Moore, is an administration that deals in this level of, let's say, let's be real charitable, and say it's borderline criminality, do you think they're morally qualified to name the next one or two people to the U.S. Supreme Court?
Well, look, I don't think they're morally qualified to do much of anything, frankly.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. You know, I've listened to George Bush and Karl Rove, you know, from way back in the 70s when I've known both of them, and I've listened to them day in and day out talk about, and I watched as Rove focused this into one of Bush's big messages where he said he was tired of the generation of if it feels good, do it, and he wanted to become the accountability president. I don't think there's been ever been an administration in the modern era that has been less accountable for its actions. And for this president to not remonstrate Rove and to not toss Rove out on his ear for doing this, it doesn't matter whether he, quote, knowingly disclosed Valerie Plame's identity. What matters is that he was involved in the immoral act of trying to make life difficult for someone working to protect the United States.
And, amen.
And on that basis alone, the president needs to toss Rove out if the president wants to retain any accountability of his own and have any moral authority.
Yeah, like that's ever going to happen. Jim, thanks for joining us. It's been great talking again. We missed you here.
Thanks, Jim.
Thanks, guys. Call anytime.
Okay, thanks, right. Jim. That's James Moore, the author of Bush's Brain, How Karl Rove Made George W. Bush Presidential. He's our Karl Rove specialist. We'll be back with... coming up next, we got Mort Mortensen's Morning Remembrance, so you know you got to stay around for that. 47 past the hour, Morning Sedition with Mark and Mark, Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition, Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
Don't just stare at it, eat it.
On Air America Radio.
Hey, folks, 52 past the hour, Mark Mariner with Mark Riley.
Hi.
It's Morning's Edition on Air America Radio. In a few minutes, we're going to figure out whether Don Rumsfeld made his deadline today. I'll explain that in a little while. Unfortunately, it's that time of the week again, though, when we here at Morning's Edition take a moment at this time of sorrow to reflect in our morning remembrance.
As the people of a grieving nation come together to mourn, to remember, and finally to find hope, Morning Sedition joins with them to mourn, remember, and find hope as well. And so we bring you the stories of those who have lost their lives, those who inspire us to carry on. Here now is Morning Sedition grief correspondent, Mort Mortensen.
Oh... What a week.
Yeah.
Mike Jurosek, inventor of baby carrots. Mike Jurosek, who invented those peeled baby carrots enjoyed as a snack food around the world by millions of heroin addicts trying to kick the habit, died last week after mistaking his own pinky for one of his carrots. It was in 1986, Mark, when Jurosek perfected a way to take misshapen and broken carrots that would ordinarily be discarded and basically make a huge fortune out of trash.
Oh, wow. Mm. You all right?
Yeah.
Okay.
The invention boosted carrot sales by 35%, inspiring Jurosek to further increase profits by miniaturizing wages.
Oh, no.
Miniaturizing wages.
I got it. Yeah.
You've been given wheatgrass to your juice? Your cats, I mean?
Yeah, I have. Would that cause this horrible...
Something's wrong with my eyes.
Yeah, maybe I should just get the cats out of here.
Hey, good idea. Many less successful Jurosek innovations followed, including baby peas. Grapelets.
Grapelets?
Yeah, grapelets.
That's a good one.
Greeny beanies. Zucchini beanies.
Oh!
And the puzzling mushroom-shaped mushrooms. That was a disaster.
That didn't work out.
Jurosek was an active volunteer at religious organizations. At one time, even offered his expertise on cutting and shaving misshapen carrots
to a shocked loyal at the local synagogue.
Come on.
Yeah, I could have left that one out.
You all right, man?
Yeah, all right.
Yeah, you think so?
Yeah. The deceased requested his bot. What am I getting? What is this, a Ramones concert?
That's a cat.
Can I get some little less monitor up here, please? The deceased requested his body be peeled, cut into 2-inch segments, and placed near a bowl of dip for hungry mourners.
Maybe the cat.
Yeah.
You want Kleenex?
Yeah, I got time for that?
Yeah, not much. All right, get on with it.
Shelby Foote, Civil War historian. Yeah. Shelby Foote, the Southern historian who in the 1990 Ken Burns Civil War documentary touched the hearts of millions of Americans with his thick Memphis drawl, died of a heart attack after tragically realizing no one could ever understand a single word he was saying. George Templeton Strong.
Yeah, that was a quote, huh?
Man, this is eating it, and it's not my fault.
So you might want to set up a quote before you say the name at the end. It's weird. Go ahead.
The hit series turned Mr. Foote into a primetime star. And at one point, he was getting at least 20 calls a day from annoying Civil War fans asking him to explain what goober peas were. Elizabeth Cady Stanton. There, that works better. Jesus, you're such a pain in the... Oh, God.
That's
depressing.
Go ahead.
Mr. Foote requested that a black and white photograph be taken of his remains so Ken Burns could slowly pan and zoom over it for 10.5 hours.
Ooh.
Elijah Hunt Rhodes.
I didn't know it was going to be a recurring joke.
Yeah. Well, of course not. You don't read ahead. Maybe if you read the damn thing, you know, once.
I wanted to enjoy it in the real time.
I know. Yeah. I know. Real time's important to you.
It is. Yeah. You're right, dude.
Maybe. Could I have some water to help?
Yeah, maybe. You know, some... You going to do all right?
Yeah, that's a lot better.
Physical comedian.
I want you to pour your nose one more time. Wrap this up.
Okay. Anyway, this has been this week's Morning Remembrance, Mark. Until next week, this is Mort Mortensen saying, who's chopping onions?
I thought that was great.
Yeah, it was.
It was. You know, I mean it. All right, we got Peter Galbraith coming up to talk about what Donald Rumsfeld needs to present Congress today, because I don't know if many of you knew this, but there is a deadline that needs to be met, and we'll tell you about it in a second here on Morning's Edition with Mark and Mark on Air America Radio.
Blah, 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 blah.
6 past the hour. It's Morning Sedition with Mark and Mark on Air America Radio. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Yes, I am.
Hey, folks, hang in there. Florida, Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia. All these states have been declared disaster areas because of the Hurricane Dennis. I hope you're doing as well as can be expected down there. The storm was not as bad as they assumed it would be, but it's still pretty damn bad, and our thoughts are with you.
Yeah.
In London, it turns out that they have no leads as of right now for the terrorist attacks that took place last week. They are reaching out to other countries, though, which is unusual, apparently, for the MI5, the one of the highest-rated intelligence agencies in the world. Reaching out to the rest of Europe to sort of assimilate and try to understand and bring information together to try and get a handle on this thing.
You know, Mark, and this is just rank speculation on my part, but I would guess it's a large number of the people that put this together are no longer in England.
Yeah. I don't know. You know, they're trying to. They've created a special relationship with Spain's some explosive experts out of Spain to try and figure out whether or not it was similar enough to the Madrid bombings to assume that they were connected with those bombers. Maybe you're right, Riley, but there's also assumptions that they were inherently that these terrorists were probably English citizens who lived there a good long time, given their knowledge of the tubes system and also where to place these bombs.
Well, it was a very sophisticated
operation. And, you know, one of the things that changed, Mark, over time was the actual time frame of the explosions. Now the British are saying, excuse me, that those explosions came virtually one right after the other. Remember, we were told that there was a timeline that lasted almost an hour between the four explosions. Apparently, the three in the subway all took place within seconds of each other, or minutes.
49 people dead, over 700 injured in England. Quickly, Jeb Bush has decided to put an end to the criminal investigation into the death of Terry Schiavo because there's just no case there. He finally had to stop politicizing this thing for his own good. Today, the Defense Department is required to give Congress a detailed accounting of future plans and benchmarks for success in Iraq. This report was ordered by Congress as part of the war funding bill passed in May. A lot of people didn't know this. Our next guest is skeptical about whether the Defense Department will deliver. Ambassador Peter Galbraith is a senior diplomatic fellow at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation. He is a former U.S. ambassador to Croatia. Ambassador Galbraith joins us on the phone from Vermont this morning. Good morning, Ambassador.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So will the Defense Department give us the information Congress has asked for?
I imagine they will submit a report, but I don't think it's going to provide meaningful benchmarks for measuring American success in Iraq. No doubt there'll be statistics about how many Iraqi troops have been trained and how much money has been spent and the amount of electricity that has been restored, but it's not likely to provide a useful measure by which Congress can determine whether the process is succeeding.
Well, you wouldn't.
Reports are fairly common. I worked for the Senate Foreign Relations Committee for many years. We'd stick them in the law. Sometimes it was a substitute for action when there was really nothing else you could think of doing.
Well, it just seems to me that if you're paying attention at all, if any of us, like, you know, we get reports every day and we do our homework here, is that, you know, certainly violence and attacks have escalated. You know, the number of troops dying has escalated. You know, there's no real sense that that militarily this thing is solvable. I mean, I don't know, you know, how we could say anything other than that, really.
Well, I think that the real problem is that we don't have a good understanding of the situation in Iraq, and as a result, we're pursuing a strategy that cannot succeed. Both this report and the president's policy are based on the idea that there is a people known as the Iraqi people.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't exist. This is a country in which people identify by their ethnic or confessional identity. The Kurds are 20% of the population. They unanimously don't want to be part of Iraq. They hate the idea of being considered Iraqis. In January, it didn't receive very much attention. They had a referendum at the same time as the election and voted for independence. The Shiites, who are the majority, 50 to 60% in the elections in January, they didn't vote for Iraqi parties. They didn't vote for the equivalent of Democrats or Republicans. They voted for a Shiite list. And that Shiite list is now basically engaged, or the Shiite government, in a war with the Sunni Arabs, who were in power for the entire history of Iraq and now are out. And the United States is looking at this as if it's the United States and the Iraqi people against the insurgents. Basically, what's going on is it's Sunni Arabs who are out and are afraid of being ruled by Shiites are at war with them, and we're now basically on the side of the Shiite government.
Now, Ambassador Galbraith, what do you make of the former interim prime minister, Iyad Alawi, an ally of Washington, saying, quote, the problem is that the Americans have no vision and no clear policy on how to go about in Iraq?
Well, I would certainly agree with Iyad Alawi, and part of the reason is that we don't understand the situation in Iraq. We imagine that this is a homogenous country, that the Iraqis are people like the Americans or the British, that there's some sense of national identity. So if we can only make the national institutions like the Army and the intelligence service stronger and more effective, they'll be able to fight the insurgents. But in fact, all we're doing is creating an intelligence service and an army that is serving the interests of the Shiite majority government that's now fighting the Sunni Arab insurgents. It's not a situation that's going to succeed. Even Saddam Hussein, who was enormously brutal and who had excellent intelligence on what was going on in Iraq, in 35 years he couldn't defeat either Kurdish or Shiite insurgencies completely. Most of the time he was in power, he faced insurgencies because those groups didn't accept Sunni Arab rule.
Mm-hmm. Ambassador, how do you think Washington will react on the day that the Kurds decide they are going to publicly press for independence?
That isn't going to happen anytime soon. That is to say, it's not going to happen in the next 3 or 4 years. The current generation of Kurdish leaders understand that that would produce a very negative reaction from Turkey, Iran, Syria, never mind the rest of Iraq. And so they're going to content themselves with keeping what they now have, which is de facto independence. They don't fly the Iraqi flag. The Iraqi army isn't allowed there. They have their own economy. They'll be content with that for the time being. But the problem is going to come in sometime down the road when there's a new generation of leaders who recognize that the population wants formal independence, and that's going to be a very powerful political card in some future election in Kurdistan.
So Iyad Alawi is obviously running for office in December, and it seems that, you know, what you're saying is that there is a war, a civil war going on between the Shia and the Sunnis, and the Sunnis are bolstered also by, you know, thousands of foreign jihadists who are, I guess, aligning with them as well. Now, what about this deadline that Rumsfeld is supposed to meet? Is that is it meaningless?
For the report?
Yeah.
I don't think there'll be any useful information in these reports. The Pentagon is very experienced with sending this kind of material to the Congress that is not responsive to what the Congress wants.
What do you think can be done to reclaim, and or not to reclaim, but to get Iraq going in the direction of becoming a state?
Oh, well, I don't think that can be done because these are groups that do not accept rule by the other group for very good reason. They have very different values. The extreme case is the difference between the Kurds and the Shiites. The Kurds are secular, Western-oriented. They're very pro-American. They would like to have a democracy, perhaps modeled on what exists in Turkey. The Shiites are religious. They want to create an Islamic state in Iraq. They are already creating an Islamic state in southern Iraq. They're paying no attention, incidentally, to the American-written interim constitution. They aren't paying any attention to the freedoms that President Bush spoke about. They are creating, as we speak, an Iranian-style theocracy in which even their shades of Taliban, not only their police that go out and enforce a dress code, their people who they've destroyed all the liquor shops and
wow.
The people who sell it, and they're even smashing the shops that sell music.
Wow. So Ambassador Galbraith, it seems like there is real no way to resolve what is going on there, and we're just going to have to wait and see.
Well, actually, I think for us it's a no-win and no-lose situation. I want to be clear. There's no chance that the Sunni Arab insurgency can win.
Right.
We're not going to see those guys knocking down the gates to the presidential palace like Saigon in 1975. It's simple demographics. They're 20% of the country, Sunni Arabs.
Okay.
So that isn't going to happen.
Okay. Well, we got to get going. I appreciate you being with us, and basically what we're saying about these benchmarks that were supposed to be met today is they'll come and go without much fanfare, and what is going on will continue to go on.
I would be amazed if anything different happened.
Thank you, Ambassador Galbraith.
Thanks, Ambassador.
Okay.
You take care. Wow. You know, every time we talk to somebody who knows, you know, like, he even brought something different to the table in terms of, you know, in my understanding of it, just with Kurdistan and with the theocracy developing. I had no idea about that. Did you?
Not really. Not the theocracy in the I believe in the southern part of the country.
I had no idea that was going on, and I feel like I'm on top of this stuff. So look, when we come up, we're going to shift gears. Coming up next, we're going to shift gears, and we're going to talk a little bit about how you're being manipulated by the media in terms of how it makes you go see movies. It is now 18 past the hour. You're listening to Air America Radio's Morning Sedition with Mark and Mark.
Join the Morning Sedition right now. Call 866-303-2270.
What?
That's 866-303-2270.
You don't know until you've tried this.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Damn good.
Two past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. I can't believe I'm going to have to buy two iPods. I can't believe that I got an iPod that's got 6 gigs in it, or seven, whatever the hell. I don't even care because I wasn't even trying to save money.
You weren't.
I waited all this time to get this iPod, and I figured like 1,500 songs, that's enough. You know, that's all, I didn't realize that, like loading your iPod's like a second job, number one. Number two, now I'm almost filled with it. I've already got it filled up. It's like phone plans. It's the same damn thing. All right. What happens is you get the phone plan that you think is going to work for you, and then all of a sudden you get your first bill. It's like, wow, $12,000. That's not what I signed up for. I signed up for a $100 phone plan. All right. So now I get an iPod. It's got 6 gigabytes on it, and like I'm already like, dude, I'm already filtering. I'm already self-censoring. It's like, well, I can't put all of those songs in because what if I want to put the other one in? And that's, where's my freedom now?
Well, no. Why did you get a 6 gig iPod?
Shut up! Shut up! I'm not even gonna like. I'm not. Why
I don't buy one? I'll tell you that right now.
The reason I got it was because I thought the bigger one, well, honestly, it looks more fragile to me. It looks like jewelry.
But yours looks paper thin.
But that's what I'm saying. Now I can drop it. I can throw it around. I can run with it. That thing looks like, oh, I don't want to drop it. I'm gonna be careful with it. I'm stupid.
Yeah.
I understand.
Now, was it the color? Is it because
shut up. It's not about color. It was just about, I just didn't want the responsibility of that one. And now I got this one because I thought I would be able to manage the problem, but I had no idea that it would become this heinous addiction
and
that is taking up all of my time. What?
You feel good now?
Well, I enjoyed it on the way in. You know, I was able to listen to some music, and I'm not going to say that I'm not enjoying it, but now I'm sitting there going, God, if I had the bigger one, I could put all of these on.
But wait a minute, Chris, didn't you have a solution for him on all this?
Well, yeah, he can sell his on eBay.
Yeah.
Oh, then I got to learn how to do eBay? This thing has turned into a malignant thing.
Guys, can I intervene here for
a
second?
We
are plugging iPods and now eBays, too, and we don't get a red cent from either of them. As a producer of the show, I'd like to ask us to move on.
All right, please. That's Brendan P.W. McDonald pitching in here. What are we doing now? The iNews, and then we're going to talk about movies? Oh, God, I can't. I'm obsessing about this thing. And I've already got 1,200 songs in there. There's 1,200 songs, and now I'm 200 shy of my limit, and I haven't even got to my jazz CDs yet. This is stupid. All right. Anyways, let's do this. All right. What am I doing? All right. Sometimes when you read the headlines, let's just get the machine out. See, iNews 5000 Wi-Fi headline translator. Let's have a good time. Here's good times. You ready? Good times. All right. From the Associated Press, Rice talks with North Korea just to start. Let's feed it into the machine. Yeah. Talks with North Korea just to start. Translation. Next up, threats, invasions, bloodbaths, quagmire, Armageddon. Oh, come on. All right, how about this one? Feed it in there again. Talks with... Oh, we're running out of time already. All right, this is the worst iNews ever. North Koreans play non-proliferation card. That's funny. Okay, I'm turning around. I'm turning the corner. From Bloomberg, Texans disregard latest mad cow scare, indulge beef appetite. Texans disregard latest mad cow scare, indulge beef appetite. Translation, experts say brain damage less likely to be noticed there. That's funny. That's in Texas because they're da la la. Except for Jim Moore, very smart Texan. From the Associated Press, panda cub born at Washington Zoo. Panda cub born at Washington Zoo. Translation: Chinese intelligence plants high-tech panda bot in Capitol. Come on! That, what do you... What is it? Was it the wrong tone? Did I have the wrong tone? Oh, my God. So Brendan came in here to talk about movies because we got this whole thing about the myth of the box office slump.
Yeah, it was kind of fascinating for me for weeks here. And the guy we're having come on here, David Poland, who's the editor of the website, MovieCityNews.com,
yeah,
is the only one that I saw talk about it. And we'd see it every week. We'd come in on Mondays and see the news that, oh, Hollywood's in another slump. And it would actually be something, oh, should we cover this?
Yeah.
And Poland, who's out in L.A., and we're going to have him on the phone, has rightfully pointed out that this is the third best season in Hollywood ever.
So who
in history?
So we're going to find out from him what is the incentive
of the
gig? Press.
I think it's just a bitterness on the part of the press. They hate Hollywood and they love putting the knife in. You know,
we'll find out from David Poland, editor of Movie City News, coming up next here. Let's get to the bottom of this. How are they using us? I think they're trying to guilt us into going movies.
Yep.
Maybe they're working for them. Maybe the media is working for the film companies. I don't know, man. 6 gigs? All right. It's 27 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Morning Tradition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
Fair America Radio's Morning Sedition. Hey, Brendan, you want to buy a 6-gig iPod? I'm serious. He's like the only guy here, Riley. I'm not even going to put you through that.
Thank you.
Because, like, if Riley, if you get one, you got to get the 40-gig one.
Yeah, I got to get a big one.
Yeah.
No doubt.
Yeah, and then it'll be your second job loading the thing.
Yeah, I know. That's why I'm not messing with it.
So, look, apparently I read a report today that the slump is over. The Fantastic Four, the superheroes, have saved Hollywood. That's what I heard. And according to our guest, David Poland, who's going to be on in just a second, he said that the slump's a myth anyways. So we got to get to the bottom of this. It's not a big investigation that needs to be done. But I'll tell you, you know, Hollywood is not short on making money, obviously. And I think we're being used on so many levels. And I think that Brendan says that the press likes to see Hollywood take a hit. I tend to believe that a lot of the press is working at the behest of Hollywood to guilt us into seeing movies. Now, let's see what our guest thinks. There have been a number of stories, obviously, about this, and our next guest says that all of it is pure media fiction. So joining us by phone, David Poland, editor of Movie City News. He's also got his own website, thehotbutton.com. David, good morning.
Good morning, guys.
So I don't know what to make of it. I rarely do I read an article about a slump in the industry and say, well, I'd better go see more movies.
Well, and thank God a quality film like the Fantastic Four is going to pull us out of the slump.
Well, they're superheroes.
They are. They're superheroes, and she's naked.
Yeah.
Whoa.
So, you know, you have your priorities.
So why do you disagree with all the news reports that say that this is has been the weakest summer ever?
Well, it's math, basically, which the reporters don't seem to bother to want to do.
They're against math.
They don't like math. It's much too complicated. And they picked one statistic, which was every weekend, comparing it to last year. Last year happened to be the highest grossing year of all time. And they hooked onto this one stat and wouldn't let go of it. And in the meantime, this year has been, up to date, the third highest grossing year of all time at the film business.
Now, let me ask you, is that because of what my producer, P.W. McDonald, says is essentially that the press likes to see Hollywood hurting, or is it more along the lines of what I'm thinking, which is that the press operates at the behest of Hollywood?
I don't think it's either. I think it's basically human nature that everybody always has a criticism of Hollywood and the movie business, and everybody, you know, some people think it's because of the quality of films, some people think it's because of DVD, some people think it's because of this or that. They all put their personal mark on the idea that there's a slump. So somehow it's kind of amusing that there's something wrong with Hollywood so they can bitch about whatever they feel like bitching about. But in the meantime, they're not looking at the actual numbers.
Right. So, and these numbers, like, you know, if you were to really crunch them and in terms of what a dollar is worth now or then, like, you know, you get this idea that Titanic is the biggest movie ever, but it wasn't.
Oh, no. Well, if you do the thing where you go back to 1939 and say, comparing Gone with the Wind's grosses, the Titanic's grosses, yes, you can, you know, make a dollar, extrapolate like that. I personally don't believe in that. I think you basically are, you know, you're dealing with a level playing field. And the business in 1930s and 1940s, completely different than it is now.
Yeah.
I mean, it used to be television. Television, people spent 6 hours a week watching television on average.
Yeah, when you wanted to rent a film back then, you had to rent a projector with it.
You couldn't. You couldn't even rent it.
I know.
The great story, of course, was back in the days when they had the 6mm projectors.
Yeah.
And you could rent a movie that everybody bought Alice in Wonderland and never returned it because people were getting stoned and watching Alice in Wonderland on the roof.
Really?
Yeah.
So I didn't know that.
They had to stop sending out copies of Alice in Wonderland because it was being stolen by every stoner in town.
Wow.
It was a hot product.
Now, David, you know, there are some people who connect this slump, rightly or wrongly, to a shift in technology. In other words, that people are really not going to go to movies, to movie houses to watch films for that much longer. Is that bunk, too?
Well, I read in the paper yesterday that, you know, people are now spending, in the L.A. Times yesterday, people are spending $10,000, $100,000 building projectors, theaters in their homes. I'm like, yeah, there are 7 people in Malibu who are building these rooms. There, you know, there are people who are buying HDTVs, but that business is not going very well. And the great irony to me is that the DVD business for films has actually gone down since the last Christmas.
Really? What do you make of that?
Well, people started buying television shows on DVD instead of buying movies on DVD as much.
Yeah, but that, our producer does that. Right. These guys are buying TV shows. Yeah, because I guess the sense is that after a certain point in time, you get that weird original, that first sort of wave of like, yeah, I got to have all these movies, and then you realize they're like, I'm not going to watch all these movies.
Well, the other thing is you can watch a movie on cable 7-8 months later where you can't ever see the first season of Different Strokes.
Right.
Now, once you, if you want to see Different Strokes, you kind of have to buy the DVD.
Oh, is that out now? No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding.
My nephew's up to season 7.5.
Uh-oh.
Arnold gets a pimple. It's very exciting.
So it's interesting that you talk about these 7 people that are building theaters in their houses. So the in actuality, people are still going to go to the movies. It seems like they're always going to go to the movies.
People want to go to the movies, but it's a different – I mean, you compare to 1949, as I say. I mean, if you wanted to be in air conditioning, you had to go to the movie theater. People went like it was – you know, it was a weekly thing. You would just go to the movies. You didn't go for a particular movie. You went to go to the movies. It's a very different business, and it has changed a little bit. I think it's going to go down every year. There are more options. But the thing is, there's more money being spent for each movie than ever before. When you consider the DVD business expanded the business and didn't really eat into the theatrical business, they're making a massive amount of money now. And the problem is the DVD business is beginning to slide, and then you're going to see real problems because now they're spending so much money to make the movies.
Right.
To fit this DVD business and the theatrical that if either business slides at all, there's some serious trouble because it's not a very high-margin business to begin with.
You mean we might have to go back to a time where they make good movies?
Well, you know, that's the theory, is that eventually that we may have to go back to a time where movies cost $40 million to make instead of $100 million to make, and maybe that will make them more creative. But I think they'll make just more cheap crap instead of more expensive crap because ultimately, if you look at movies through history, there's always a vast majority of crap.
Yeah.
And there's always 10% that's really good. And that's really the reality of art. I mean, it's really, it's true on Broadway, it's true in theater and television, it's true in film.
Yeah, and the advent of DVD technology actually enables them to resell the crap in a much more creative, they're very creative in reselling crap, because I've always wondered, how long is it going to take people to realize that, hey, if it wasn't in the theater, it's a real good chance it's crap. So, you know, maybe you shouldn't rent it or buy it.
Well, they keep on sucking money out of, you know, everybody's pocket in every which way possible. The next thing is going to be HD DVD, which I hope will fail, but it's coming. But, yes, you're right. And the thing is, I think that the HD and the DVD revolution is actually great for independent films.
Mm-hmm.
The opportunity potentially to get a movie like, you know, Control Room in your house the day it comes out, if it expands the opportunity, that's great for that movie.
Right.
But for Hollywood, they have every kind of opportunity possible.
Mm-hmm.
And they just have to spend more and more money chasing the dollars. But in the meantime, the dollars are expanding also. So if somebody would actually stop and say, okay, we're not going to spend quite as much on movies, somebody could make a huge windfall in the current marketplace. But nobody's quite that smart in Hollywood.
Now, David Poland, one thing I see in watching some of these stories about box office is that they tend, particularly when they're talking about a slump, to single out particular movies, whether it's Herbie Fully Loaded or Rebound or whatever. How does that play a role, if at all?
Well, the secret in the slump is that they're doing weekends only, not weekdays. So the weekday business is actually up this year a bit. And so if you go week by week, there are weeks that are actually up and not there hasn't been this long a slump, according to the quote-unquote slump.
Mm-hmm.
So then it becomes an obsession with each week. So then you're comparing War of the Worlds to Spider-Man 2 and Herbie the Love Bug to this and that. And in the meantime, Herbie, which everybody said was such a bomb 2 weeks ago when it opened, is already up to $50 million.
Thank God for kids.
Kids love those movies. And yeah. So then when you look at, now you'll see review comments this week about the box office and say, Herbie's only up to $50 million, you know, and it's going to only get to $70-something million. Well, for Herbie the Love Bug to do $70 million is very strong.
Oh, it's a self-fulfilling thing then, because I notice that happens all the time, is yeah. that, you know, initially there's panic, but then it seems to... I mean, I think it actually, there is some sort of guilt to it on some level. I think some people have that moment where they're like, well, we should go see that.
Yeah. Well, there's always the genius of, you know, of War of the Worlds only made $114 million in its first 6 days. Oh, my God, what a nightmare.
Did you see it?
Yes, I don't like the movie.
Yeah? Why not?
Because I think it was just thin and vapid and not particularly... ultimately, Tom Cruise's character was not that interesting, and the family wasn't that interesting, and that's all you really had.
Does he play a Scientologist?
You know, the funny thing about the movie is, after watching him jump on couches for a month, and everybody in Hollywood has a Tom Cruise imitation they do now,
uh-huh.
You know, you walk into a room, you see people jumping up and down, you go, oh, Tom Cruise. literally, you'll see reporters, like, doing this Tom Cruise dance. But he's playing that character in the movie also.
Oh, really?
He's so hyperactive in the movie that it's kind of like, oh, my God, maybe it's really him. That's very scary.
Does he say that he doesn't believe in psychiatry in the movie?
He actually aliens, and he says, no, you can't have a pill.
But... Yeah, no, please, no pills. Yeah. David Pollan, editor of Movie City News, and also the hotbutton.com is your site. What are your picks for this summer, then?
In terms of quality?
Well, it's not, you know, in terms of movies you liked.
Well, so far, Batman Begins is about the only real choice out there, and even that is, you know, ultimately a comic book.
Right, but it's a good one, though, right?
Up. The two movies that are coming up in August that are mm-hmm. really good
mm-hmm.
are The Constant Gardener, which is a the guy who did City of God last year or 2 years
ago. That movie's a masterpiece, dude.
Yes, it is. And the new movie, Constant Gardener, which is about African, it's a John le Carré novel set in Africa, is really quite brilliant.
Great.
And The 40-Year-Old Virgin is the surprise of the summer in the end. Steve Carell,
yeah, he's hilarious.
Hysterical, and the movie is completely raunchy and completely hysterical. It's like Wedding Crashers plus. I mean, Wedding Crashers is okay. 40-Year-Old Virgin is actually hysterically funny.
And what's the word on the new, who is it? Is it Jarmusch's film? Is it the Bill Murray?
I love Broken Flowers, yeah. Broken Flowers with Bill Murray and Sharon Stone's in it and all these people. Really a fine, good quality movie, that's true. It's coming.
Well, great. Well, we should check in with you more often. Are you up for getting up this early to talk movies?
You know, as long as there's somebody over to knock me over, I'll be happy to wake up.
All right, David Pollan, thanks a lot.
No problem. Thank you.
Thanks, David.
Wow, okay. Well, that's got me excited. I didn't realize that the guy who did City of God has done a new film.
Did
you see that one?
No, I haven't seen it.
Oh, my God.
I've been in it. I live in a cave when I leave.
Okay, man. So when we come back, Riley's going to tell us about the cave.
Thank you.
It's 45 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition.
Just wake up.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
I've heard about those people.
On Air America Radio.
Thanks.
Past the hour, it's Galandis saying it's Mark Maron here, Riley over there, and
hey,
it's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Is this song on your iPod?
Yeah. No, you know what? This CD, I went out and actually tried to find because I think
room for it, do you?
I wanted to buy the first five CD, ZZ Top albums. I have a three CD collection.
Uh-huh.
They're not all great though. ZZ Top, the first five albums are right, but once they grew the beards, they started to suck. This was part of the good ones. And no, I might not have room on it. Thanks for reminding me. And then Pashman comes in, Dan Pashman, son of Lewis and Linda Pashman, who we no longer talk about on this station. came in and told me that 6 gigs for the money is the worst deal. And it had nothing to do with money, my decision. That's what's eating me up, because I literally said to Dan Pash when he said you should just get the 20 gig or the 40 gig, I said, no, how much, you know, I only need 1,500 songs. And then I forgot, because I hadn't been listening to music for so long, that I like to listen to whole albums. That sometimes, there are some bad songs, but sometimes you want to hear the whole record. And being that I don't have a stereo, I'm using it as my stereo now, and it's just taken over my life.
Well, you and many other Americans are using it as a stereo. But I think what they're trying to say to you, Mark, is that if you're going to go into this, you got to go whole hog.
But that's what I did when I bought my wife hers. I got her the biggest one, and I said, well, why don't you just give me yours? You've only got like 1,200 on yours. And she goes, because when my hard drive crashed, I lost all my songs. So now she's got like literally probably 38 gigs, whatever the hell that means, unused on hers, but she's not willing to give it to me.
No, and you're not getting it.
Yeah, so what do you use for a stereo in the cave?
Huh? I have an old school stereo. I got a pair of Boston acoustic speakers. I got another pair of Polk speakers. I got an amplifier, and I got a CD player.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I got.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a NAD CD player, which I got only about 4 or 5 months ago. The CD player I had before that at Nakamichi lasted me like 12, 13 years.
Nakamichi, that's some high-end stuff there.
Well, I mean, the Boston acoustic speakers I've had for better than 20 years.
Yeah, but does that stuff age well? You know, things progress, they advance. Now you've gotten used to it.
Yeah, I've only had to get them reconed once in 23 years, and mm-hmm. The music sounds wonderful.
Wow. Well, there you go.
Yeah.
So if you want to go old school,
that's old school.
Go see if you can find some of this vintage equipment that
in
Mark
the cave, yo. By the way, we met. I met the owner of Academy Records, Joseph.
Yeah.
He was at our Tea Lounge gig. I mentioned a particular song to him that I was looking for and could not find, and just the other day, Joseph sent it to me. It was amazing.
Wait, what happened now? You mentioned
there was a piece
him?
Of music I was trying to find and could not find anywhere. I went to every music store
and he found it for you.
He found it for me.
So you're this guy's.
I'm eternally in his debt.
Well, in his debt, I'm sitting here thinking, well, I need the first 5 ZZ Top CDs.
Well, he could probably find them for you.
Those are easy though. I got to think of something more challenging. We got a phone call from let's see, Rebecca in Washington. Hi, Rebecca. What's up?
Hi, Rebecca.
Hi, Mark. And Mark, how you doing?
Good. What's on your mind?
Well, I just wanted to tell you, with that iPod, if you signed the back of that thing with a Sharpie pen, I bet you could sell it for a lot of money.
With my music in it?
Yeah.
That's a pretty good idea. I'd like to think I have those kind of fans. So, Rebecca, are you interested in a signed iPod?
Sure, Mark.
But she's not willing to pay for it.
We can negotiate.
Uh-oh.
Okay. Shoot me an email at sedition at airamericaradio.com, and we'll discuss it. I'll send it to you loaded if we can come up with a price. Thanks, Rebecca.
That sounds good.
Okay.
Thanks, Rebecca.
I just solved my problem. I just sold my iPod.
Hey, but, pays to have a radio show, don't it?
U2 actually made a lot of money doing that. They have a U2 iPod.
That's one thing I decided not to buy. What the hell is that? It's the little black iPod for...
It's not little. It's bigger than yours. It's like twice the size of yours,
God,
right?
Here we go. Twice the size.
Everything's bigger than mine. I'm fighting with Lucy, our booker. Lucy, Irish Lucy.
She's a tough one.
Yeah.
I think we should have her on the air sometimes.
Can't say that, you moron.
I'm sorry.
Just because you heard her say it doesn't mean you can say it.
I thought that was...
You can say Shiite, the group.
Oh, that's what
people.
I meant you were saying. Yeah,
right.
I'm sorry. I didn't realize. I thought that if it was in Gaelic that we were allowed to say it.
No, poo is still a bad word.
Yeah.
All right, poo in Gaelic is a bad word. Well, Lucy, like right away, she like I tell her I get my iPod, she's like, oh, no, you're going to have to get the bigger one. You know, and I'm like, what are you talking?
Even she knew.
Well,
yep.
So now I'm like, I didn't realize that I'd be walking around with this insecurity about the size of my pod. You understand? I'd just gotten over the other insecurity about the size of my my other thing.
There's truth to that. I mean, I walk around with my iPod, and I was in the elevator here, and some guy with a suit comes in, and he sees my iPod. He's like, oh, what's that, like the 20 gig? I'm like, no, jerk ass, it's the 40 gig. And he's like, oh, I'm sorry.
You can say jerk ass. This doesn't seem fair. Who the hell makes these rules? Now I'm sitting here thinking, like, you know, like, the thing is, like, I'm completely comfortable with the size of
your liberal?
Yeah, of my thing. But my iPod is now making me insecure in this. All right. I don't want anyone to think I got a little thing. Do you know what I mean? I just have a little iPod. All right, so here's the liberal agenda from the Streisand compound for your weekly events or whatever, marching orders. One, expand vegan principles to the next level. Refuse to engage in meaty discussions. Two, start a filibuster at Viacom headquarters to block any possible nomination of Judge Judy to Supreme Court. Judge Judy! Three, declare Hurricane Dennis a destructive push through Florida's God's punishment for not approving gay marriage. Four, to fight national obesity, propose movie title change, Charlie and the Organic Sprouts Farm. All right, five, today's phrase, just drop it into conversation. The Fantastic Four is the most realistic film Hollywood ever made. In a group of powerful people, there's only one woman, and she's invisible. Wake up, sheeple. Even female superheroes can't break through the glass ceiling.
Uh-oh.
Oh, man. So 6 gigs, I got a small pod.
I will not fear my meat.
I don't. I'm not afraid of my meat at all.
You must have quite a package.
I do have a large package.
Not I have a tiny package.
No, I don't. I have a tiny iPod. Look, you want to see the other thing? Now we've done it.
Yeah,
now
really.
We crossed the line.
Poopy duty.
Oh, man.
I used to love the fat guy.
Who's on the show tomorrow, right?
Hey, man, you know who we got
pull
tomorrow?
Us down. Pull
Al
us down.
Cooper is coming in here tomorrow from Blood, Sweat, and Tears.
He's been on everything. He was the organ on Like a Rolling Stone. He signed Lynyrd Skynyrd. This guy is the history of modern music.
Oh, yeah, and we've also got comedian and actor Rick Overton will be coming by, and the Liberal Confessional.
Good show, Riley.
Good show.
Morning Sedition on